Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Belinda Castles makes her first appearance at the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of her novel Hannah and Emile. Belinda's previous novel, The River Baptist, won the Australian Vogel Award for Literature for 2006, and in 2008 she was named one of the Sydney Morning Herald's Best Young Novelists. And she works as a book editor and has just completed a DCA in Creative Writing at the University of Western Sydney, which is very impressive depending on what DCA really means. What does DCA mean? A Doctor of Creative Arts, a doctor no less. Well done, Belinda. And she's a blogger and everything else, but tonight she's here to talk about her book, Hannah and Emile. Many thanks, Belinda. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. Good evening. Thank you for having me at the Sydney Institute. I would like to tell you about how our family came to live in Australia. I know very much more now about this journey than I did before, because about 5 years ago I decided to write a novel based on my grandparents' lives. Even now though, with my study full of boxes of paper and books on this history, and my own book now published, I don't know the things I would really like to know. Some background first on the Australian connection. My grandfather, Heinz Schlösser, a German veteran of the First World War and political opponent of Nazism, was forced to flee Germany in 1933, leaving appalling loss behind him. He met my grandmother, Faye, a translator at the Maison du Peuple in Brussels, where she worked for the trade union movement. They settled in England, her home, and ran a youth hostel until 1940, when Heinz was arrested as an enemy alien. He was soon afterwards sent to Australia on the Dunera, with 2,000 mainly Jewish, Germans and Austrians, and interned at Hay Camp in the Riverina. There are many people living in Australia now who trace their Australian origins to this moment, and the men who were sent here made many contributions to the intellectual and cultural life of this country. The vibrancy of the life they made in Hay has been well documented. The orchestra, theatre, chemistry lectures and chess games. Also, if you read the men's diaries, the loneliness and bewilderment, the sheer uselessness of sitting out the war behind barbed wire. Writing the book, I had to make 1,000 decisions about what I thought might have happened, what it might have felt like, which things mattered, which did not. I thought of what I was doing as a kind of presumptuous gift to my grandparents, who had died long before. On the one hand, to imagine what another person has suffered is an act of empathy that takes into account another person's humanity, the importance of their life story and what it meant to them. On the other, there is perhaps an arrogance in presuming to know such things from this distant place. Still, when it's family, you can't help wanting to know, because it is your story too, and the story of your children. To know the past through family is fraught and partial, but very powerful. The past we inherit is the one that interests us, that draws us in with its questions. How then to separate this family history out from the big history, with its deluge of material that does not tell me what I really want to know, which is, put simply, what was it like for them? For me, the story was fuelled by photographs, personal papers, and being in the places my grandparents had been. I'd like to share some photographs with you, some of which were given to me in the process of my research, and some that I took when I visited my grandfather's hometown in Germany. I hope that in seeing these, you may experience some of the strange flashes of feeling these photographs emit to me from my family's past. These pictures do not relate directly to the Dunera episode, but they're important to me because they conveyed the timbre of this story. They told me in their way of my grandfather's life, and in so doing, what it may have meant to travel to the other side of the world during that war. Fiction can suggest the complexity of our personal histories. One thing matters because this happened first. These photographs give me the sense of a character defined by the decisions he made in those particular times, even if this character is not, strictly speaking, my grandfather. So here's the first of the photographs. It's part of a series, the others of which helped me to establish that this is Winchester in the 1930s. Here, Heinz ran a youth hostel with my grandmother Faye until his arrest in 1940. The enigma of this photograph is the boy on his shoulders. This boy, whose facial features mirror my grandfather's, is neither my father nor the uncle that I know, both of whom have black curly hair and were born later during the war in Melbourne. The existence of this boy was known to us. When Heinz died, Faye told her sons that Heinz had once been married to a German woman with whom he had had a son who fought for the Hitler Youth Army. Heinz had never spoken of this, and in my own mind such things were part of a dim, unfathomable family past. Heinz died before I was born, and so his secrets were part of that misty era that precedes us, the time we think of as before. And yet here is the boy, not a secret or a shadow, sitting on his father's shoulders in the sunshine, a makeshift cape protecting his bare skin, his father very gently holding his hands. If you look closely at their hands, you can see that my grandfather also holds a cigarette. This is not a history, but a family photo, a moment in two lives that, for all its casual intimacy, must have been rare. It's also a strange kind of proof. Here's another from the same sequence. We go to the next one. There. So that's Faye, my grandmother, on the right. You might see a family resemblance. Between my grandparents are the boy and a woman as fair as the child. She was in the previous photograph, hovering in the background. Here they are then. Heinz, his ex-wife, their son, and his English lover, Faye. The boy smiles shyly, his skinny body leaning towards his father. Heinz looks off into the distance as though he can see the future. But this is fanciful, of course. I never saw a photograph in which he smiled. I am told and well believed that he was a very serious person, although he sang and danced with the young people that stayed in their hostels and told grim, elusive jokes about his experiences in the First World War. It's hard to explain what I took from these photographs. I think that many writers whose main work is fiction find such things difficult to pin down in anything other than narrative form. I do know that the sequence in the book that covers this episode in Heinz's life took many drafts, and to me was the most important part of the novel. To know what the journey on the Dunera meant, we have to know the men's stories, what they carried with them on that long, brutal, dangerous voyage. In one of the secret compartments of my grandfather's heart, I believe there was a boy with pale hair. But this was not all he carried. To tell you about the next photographs, I need to go back further into Heinz's life in Germany. Heinz was forced to flee the country because he opposed the Nazi regime. He was a social democrat and part of the Reichsbanner, who guarded SPD members from violence at rallies and organised to oppose the threat of Hitler. His father, Johann Schlösser, was secretary of the Metalworkers' Union in Duisburg, in the industrial Ruhr region of Germany. Johann had been a former, or moulder, as had his own father. On the 2nd of May 1933, following Nazi-controlled May Day celebrations, SS and stormtroopers occupied union offices across Germany. In Duisburg, they hung swastikas from the windows, harassed workers, and it eventually transpired, beat up and shot four union secretaries in the cellar. It is possible, I found in my research, that this local action, more violent than others carried out nationally, was in part a response to Heinz's activities. It seems likely that Heinz was importing arms to oppose the Nazis. In notes taken at the murderer's pre-trial hearing after the war, witnesses say that they were looking for hidden weapons. Heinz's murdered father and his three colleagues are commemorated in the town, and I visited the memorials with my German cousin during my research. A current union official took us to them and described in detail what he believes happened that day. He has written about the episode extensively for publications on union history in Germany. I would venture to say that this history is personal for this man. He writes in a kind of folk style, which is intimate and affectionate about the personalities of the murdered men. He does not write fiction, and yet perhaps he has been on the same kind of journey as I have, moved by the other documents to bring these people back to life, to imagine them as living beings, not the corpses in the woods later found by walkers that they became. Okay, so this is the first of the memorials. The unionist showed us this memorial outside the current union offices in Duisburg. These very long sculptures are coffin-like, and their material, various metals, is designed to degrade in weather and to convey the men's connection with metalworking. Then he took us to where the original union building of my great-grandfather's days had stood. On the pavement outside what is now a very ordinary block of flats was a row of four square metal chairs, each of them facing a concrete wall. The official explained the symbolism to us. The place of work where the chairs sit is also a prison. The chairs symbolise the men, and their square shape represents the strength of the union. This sculpture was meant as a Stolperstein, a stumbling block, something placed in your path so that you stumble over it and remember. Since the 1990s, the word Stolperstein has come to refer to the copper-coated plaques the size of cobblestones laid in the streets of European towns to memorialise a single deported and murdered victim of the Nazis, showing where they lived or worked. Cultural historian Joseph Pearson writes, "It is not what is written on the Stolpersteiner which intrigues, because the inscription is insufficient to conjure a person. It is the emptiness, void, lack of information, the maw of the forgotten, which gives the monuments their power and lifts them from the banality of a statistic. And yet from the inscription, the stumbler can infer the horror." Very close to us, as we looked at this memorial, was the cellar where the men were beaten and shot. I knew from my grandmother's memoirs that my grandfather, Heinz, was in a building across the street from his father's office when the SS and SA entered, that he saw his father go in, and that he himself at some point after this fled. Here is the place where the homely, or Heimlich, my great-grandfather's place of work, becomes unhomely or unheimlich, uncanny, haunting. Marking the place between life and death for those who were taken, these memorials ask us to imagine such moments. Okay, we'll go on to the next one. Next slide. Thank you. That's fine. Behind the chairs, there is a vent in the building that presumably leads to the cellar where the men were murdered. I felt a kind of horror of that vent, the threshold into that place, and a deep sympathy towards this ancestor that I had never met. I want to present you with one last picture, one that I cannot show you because it exists only in my head. There were other journeys in my research, one of which led me to Hay, Heinz's first Australian home, on the vast, flat, red-brown plains of that part of the Riverina. There is nothing left of the camp. There's a rifle range there now, but people remember it, and at the now defunct train station are a couple of old carriages used as a museum. From here, the men marched the several hundred metres to the camp. The man who looks after the museum came out to talk to me as I looked around the carriages. As he asks everyone who comes here, I imagine, he asked me what my connection to this story was, and I told him. He let me take notes from many of the files in his office and talked about his personal memories of the men, some of whom he got to know, and of their arrival. His father had had word somehow that they were coming and took him to see. My host was a small boy at the time and remembered the men pouring from the trains and a machine gun on the platform pointed at them. I can see this man as a little boy on the platform, partially obscured by his father, watching as these thin, ragged men disembark and shuffle along to the camp. That day, more than 70 years before, was still with him. Perhaps he saw my grandfather, perhaps my grandfather saw him, this little boy sheltered by his father's body. Heinz's journey to Australia was the first of many made by the members of our family. My grandmother Faye moved heaven and earth to follow him, and then again to eventually have him released for war work. Their journeys led to my father and uncle being born in Australia, as well as my brother and sister, their children and my children. This is a migrant story, one that involves many crossings and recrossings between Australia and Europe. I feel expanded and enriched by knowing as much as I do of my grandfather's journey and of hearing other people's stories of those times. This presumptuous gift I have made to my grandparents is a more straightforward kind of gift to my living family. It is what I have made of what I have learned. I do still wonder, though, what it was like. So I might finish just with a reading so you can see my imagined version of what it was like. Okay, so they're on the ship. By their third day at sea, rumours rippled and skirmished among the men in their hammocks and tables. Though the sky was overcast, it was possible for all to see, from the light at morning exercise, that they were not going west. During their 20-minute jog around the deck, in which the weaker, slower men were insulted and hectored, an older man with shoulders like a wrestler's, a Nazi, said to Emil, "They tell me you have a compass." Emil pretended not to hear. The Nazi pushed him. Emil punched him in the nose, blood appearing straight away at his nostrils. The English guard beside them, Cook, a man who seemed to be of subnormal intelligence, perhaps even brain damaged, and who took great pleasure in violence of any sort, let out a whoop. "That's it, Jerry. Show him what you're made of." The officer at the bow ordered the men to keep moving and jabbed a boy close to him with the butt of his rifle. That night, Emil lay in the hammock, trembling. He felt Solomon stand from the table and loom over him in the light from the dim lantern tied to the crossbeams above. "You're shaking," he was saying. "Your shirt is wet. I'll take you to the infirmary." Emil stared past him, seeing not the men in the shadowy bowels of the ship, but Papa, thin, young, running away from him on the ice, pulling a pale-headed boy on a sled. Solomon took hold of Emil's arm and pulled him gently to his feet. Emil was aware intermittently that someone was trying to bear him along the gangways and up and down stairs. He was confused by the darkness, the soldiers that reared up out of the shadows. "I'm a prisoner of the British," he thought. "They will put my head on a stick." Each time he attempted to take his own weight, both men fell on the floor, and it took minutes for Solomon to get him back on his feet, sliding him up against the metal wall to manage it. When they finally reached the infirmary, the 20 or so beds were filled with men with dysentery, bayonet wounds and one suicide attempt, his wrists bandaged. Emil stared at the man's soiled bandages as he lay there with his eyes closed, and Solomon moved him on to where several men sat on wooden foldaway chairs at the end of the room. One of them noticed Solomon and Emil and stood. Solomon slipped Emil's arm from round his neck and dropped him into the chair. "Where are the medical officers?" Emil heard him say. He looked like he was shouting, and then he looked like Thomas. So they were both prisoners. He couldn't help but feel relieved. The man nodded towards one of the beds, where there was a man in uniform, as dishevelled and forlorn in sleep as the men around him. His friend, it was Solomon now, said something to Emil's neighbour, who put out a hand to keep Emil upright in his chair, while Solomon approached the sleeping medical officer. Emil saw one man stand over another, could not establish who they were. It was a ship with soldiers, but one of these men was a friend trying to help him. Without his help, he would die. Something had gone wrong inside his body. His blood was poison. He recognised the feeling, but he did not know from where. The man Solomon was shaking jolted, sat upright immediately, and Emil lurched forward, thinking to save his friend from a blow. He was falling forward. The man with his hand on his arm pulled him back onto the chair. His friend was talking to the man who'd woken and was pointing to Emil. They approached him together. The man placed his hand on his forehead. The hand was very cool and dry. How was this man so cool in this furnace? "Could it be malaria?" Solomon asked the man in English. "I think he was in Palestine and Turkey." The man nodded thoughtfully and said something from deep underwater, and they began to manoeuvre themselves under his arms to take him somewhere. The man in the chair next to him began to grumble. He was upset about something. "Hours," he said, "hours and hours." No one had a chance to answer him, because just then a thump hit the ship low down behind them, and several of the men fell off their beds and started screaming. Emil was wrenched from the grasp of Solomon and the doctor and fell to the floor. It smelled of ammonia, but it was cold, a nice cold, hard surface under his cheek. A second strike shook the floor, and he saw the blur of feet rushing towards the door. Solomon and the doctor steadied themselves and pulled Emil to his feet. There was an English voice in the corridor. "Stay below, stay below." When they had grappled Emil back onto a bed, the doctor went out to the stairway. "What's going on? Are we under attack?" he called up to the guard. "Shouldn't we get ready to evacuate?" "Orders are to stay below. Just do as you're told." Then there was a soldier in the room, hurtling from the stairwell into the infirmary. A big man like a stupid bull, pushing patients from their beds onto the floor. The soldier crashed through the beds towards Emil, face red, and then he was pulling him onto the floor and kicking him in the head, once, twice, screaming at him. "Do I know this man?" was all Emil could manage to think. There was a feeling amid the assault that some old trouble was surfacing, something he believed himself done with. His head flashed with bright light, as though something had detonated inside it. He heard someone scream as the explosions in his head came one upon the other. "Filthy German swine have torpedoed us. We will all die, you filthy kraut." He felt liquid in his ear, saw nothing. Then there were men on every side, German voices, gathering around his attacker, bearing him away. He felt his friend help him onto the bed. He recognised his voice, and when he opened his eyes, he saw him, knew him. It was Solomon Lech, the man with the books, the man who didn't drown. If this man stayed with him, he would be all right. He was lucky. Solomon pulled a chair along the bed and rested on Emil's legs, arms and head, pinning them down so that he would not fall off. Solomon fell asleep instantly. At some point, the medical officer returned and gave him quinine. He knew the smell as it came towards his face. Ah, yes. Emil closed his eyes and felt the doctor touch his ear, pat the dried blood with something that stung. When he had gone, Emil slipped himself inside himself into a place where the man kicked him until he could not see. For the rest of the night, Emil understood that the screaming man was a Nazi, that the British Army was run by them now, and that none of them would ever see land, nor even daylight again. Thank you.
So many thanks to Belinda Castles. Dr. Belinda Castles.
Not quite.
For a doctor, she's soon to be. And Janet Grundy's got copies of Hannah and Emil, and I'm sure Barbara's happy to sign some later. That's your copy. So we come to questions and discussion. Thanks for an important address. I mean, as you know, you're a novelist, but you could also write non-fiction from what you've said tonight, or you could write biography. You could write history or biography. Now, you've spoken... If we just go back to the non-fiction part of your address rather than the parts from your novel you read out at the end. You've spoken about a grandfather who has a German non-Jewish background. I think you have a grandmother, paternal grandmother, right? Who has a German background. As you know, very few non-Jews left Germany in the 30s, but your father did, or was forced out of Germany in the 30s. And so the people on the boat are essentially, on the Dniera, are essentially German Jews, unlike your father. But tell us a bit about your grandmother's story, because she obviously escaped the Holocaust as well. So if you... Apart from your father's line down to Australia on the Dniera, through Britain into Australia, what about your grandmother's line?
Okay, so just to clarify a few points. My grandmother actually was not German. She was Jewish. She was from a Russian-Jewish family, but grew up in Britain. So I will tell you a bit about her, because she was equally interesting. So she grew up in the West End of London. Her father was, he ran a tobacconist on Tottenham Court Road. So they lived in a flat above the shop on Tottenham Court Road. And as a child, and I know this because she left behind unpublished memoirs and always wanted to be a writer. She sort of had the freedom of the West End. So she spent her childhood roaming the West End, going to the British Museum around the corner, knowing all the characters around there, and traipsing about the place with her two little brothers. She lived through the First World War and was evacuated to a village at the end of the train line. And she talks about the bizarre experience of seeing that all the hedges were cut off at quite a low level, and then realising as the bombers came back from their raids that they were next to an airfield. So this was why the hedges were so strange. And she relates lots of lovely little stories from then. So what happened was she took herself off. She had some kind of disagreement with her family and took herself off around Europe to learn languages at quite a young age, and ended up in Germany, learning German and becoming a translator. She then went to work in Brussels for the trade unions, and one day my grandfather fetched up there, having crossed the border, I think into Holland and then into Belgium. So they were together from that moment on. They went back to Britain and eventually got this job running a youth hostel in Winchester, and this was where my grandfather was arrested in 1940. And somehow my grandmother used her Labour Party connections and trade union connections to get herself on a ship to Australia soon after him, and followed him out to Hay, and somehow found herself lodgings with an old lady who lived there. So that was her. She was, and I've a lot of what I've got from the novel was in the archives in Canberra, and it consists of a big wadge of letters that she sent to the Prime Minister's office, every office that she could think of, badgering them to get him out, because the situation was that he was officially released by the Home Office almost as soon as he got here, but because the Australians had not asked for him, he couldn't be released here. He had to go back to England if he was going to be released. But by this stage, Faye was here and couldn't afford the passage back. So they were stuck in this awful bind. So she threatened and bullied people until he was released for war work.
Thank you. So there's a question here. Yeah.
It's always very interesting what you said about this, the trade union support. Because when I did this at the Phillips, in history at the university, they said originally, for quite a long while, it was maintained it was the workers who voted for Hitler. But an American historian went through and looked through every election and ballot place and got all the votes of who voted for Hitler. And one of the things came out wasn't. The workers seemed to have stuck with the Labour Party, whatever they called it, and the Catholics stuck with the Catholic Party, and the people who voted for Hitler were the Conservatives, more of the Protestant parties, and people who'd lost a lot during the, when the money went crazy, and the same sort of farmers of Prussia. And I thought that was quite interesting that this sort of satellite confirmed, the workers were not actually Nazis.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't generalise, but from what I read, one of the problems was that there was so much splintering in the Weimar Republic that these small parties, as they became, just didn't organise together to oppose the Nazis. So they were all smaller groups, and the communists and the socialists didn't get together in any kind of convincing way to overcome them.
I don't mind another question.
A slightly shorter one, but the first one was interesting. Go on.
Well, my husband was a Dunera boy. Yep. One of the stories that goes around is they got on the train to go to Hay, And then, well, you know, if there's a soldier there with a gun, and the soldier says, look, oh, will you hold my gun, please, while I light a cigarette?
I've heard that one too.
So, just repeat, I mean, do you think it's true? This is the story that on the train to Hay, that the Australian soldier says to the De Niro guy, can you hold my rifle, I've got to light a cigarette. Probably true, isn't it?
It wouldn't surprise me if some part of that was true. I think. I mean, it sounds apocryphal, but I think what it shows is that they on the De Niro, for whatever reason, there was certainly an element of the British military that were nasty, and it seems to be fairly widely accepted that when they came to Australia, the treatment suddenly improved markedly. And that story suggests to me, even if it's not true in every detail, that suddenly there were these men with guns who weren't pointing them at them and who were fairly relaxed about them.
Now, we've got plenty of questions. So, right, we've got plenty of time. Anne?
Yeah. I noticed in the promotional blurb for your book that this seems to have come to you a lot from when you went to the papers, the letters, after their death. So growing up in Australia, because you referred to the difference between Australia and Europe just then in your last answer, how much of this came through to you as an individual just from family anecdotes, or did you just really get a moment when you realised there was a lot there you didn't know and you went to it through their documents?
Okay, well, it's a bit of both. And I grew up in England, because there's been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing in our family. My father came back as an adult, and I grew up in England and then came here as an adult. But when my grandfather died, my father and his uncle were told two things that they hadn't known before, which I can only assume was because Heinz had said, you know, these are not to be spoken of. One was the existence of this boy, that blonde boy that was in the photographs. So my father had not known that he existed or that there was a previous wife. And the sort of shocking thing about this boy was that he fought for the Hitler Youth Army at the end of the war. The other thing that they were told was that they were Jewish, that my father and my uncle were Jewish, that Faye was Jewish, and this had never been mentioned before for some reason. So to be told these two things at once, about this boy that fought for Hitler and that they themselves were Jewish, I think that's a couple of cracking family secrets, you know. And so I grew up with those things. My grandmother was quite a significant figure in my life. She was very bossy. She was quite glamorous in that she had this big flat in West Hampstead. I never knew my grandfather, so she was a widow. She was still working into her 60s. She was travelling to Europe and translating. She was always surrounded by typewriters, books, foreign dictionaries, telling me how translation worked, showing me the sentences. And then as an adult, I was given these letters that she'd sent back to Australia after they went back to England. And she died by then, and I could hear her voice. So I had all these things while I was growing up, but then when I heard that, I just thought it was almost as though I was waiting for something like that. I thought, this is it. I've got it. I can hear her. I know that I can do something with this. And then all this other stuff came.
Before we go to the next question here, what happens to the young boy? I mean, all young kids were conscripted into the Hitler Youth. That's not unusual. Yeah. So what's his fate?
I think I can't tell you because it's something that you should read to find out.
So what you're saying is that part's not fiction.
No,
that part's not fiction.
No, and actually the outcomes for people in the book are as they were, pretty much.
We've got a crib sheet, kids. Right, so we're going here, then we're going down the back. Yeah, we've got plenty of time.
Having regard to your De Niro research, can you shed some light on the truth or otherwise of the claim that the British cabinet papers in relation to the Lanera are marked never to be released?
Look, I don't know about that, and I came across that too. There was some material, I think, that became available maybe 50 years after the episode, but about that, I don't know. And to be completely honest, there was a point where I stopped researching because you could go on forever, and I wasn't writing history. I was trying to imagine what my grandparents had experienced. So some of my research is not as full as it would be for a historian.
So we go right down the back. Yeah, then we'll come up. Yeah.
The people here, they may be interested to know that the colonel who was in charge of the troops on the Delira was court-martialed, and the particularly brutal sergeant, who incredibly was a BC widow from the First World War, he also was prosecuted. And it's interesting that in the middle of a war, you know, that the British would be able to do that.
Yes, that they would even bother. Because, I mean, I think part of the context of the Dinera is that it all happened very quickly, this internment of the men after the evacuation of Dunkirk. So there was a kind of a panic abroad as the Germans grew closer, and it actually seemed that Britain would be invaded. So it surprises me too that they found the time.
Ironically, the sergeant is still regarded as a little bit of a hero in the video from when he came to the DC winner from World War I.
So the decision was that the sergeant, who was a hero from World War I, is still regarded in his village, well regarded in his village in England, but he was put on. He was charged by the British authorities for his handling of people on the Dinera, just in case people didn't hear it. So we go right to the back. Yeah.
You showed a photo of your step-grandmother and your step-uncle.
Yes.
Was that, and they seemed very friendly.
Yes.
What's the background for that?
I have no idea. I mean, this is... I don't know what happened to her. I'm not going to say what happened to the boy. But I don't know what the story behind that picture is. I don't know why they would all be together in this way, except that they overcame the obvious discomforts so that Heinz could see the boy. I mean, this is all I can...
Was that in England?
Yes, it was. I had another picture.
The sign on the building suggests that it was in Germany.
Really?
I think so.
I didn't notice that.
Another look.
Do you want to go back to the...
So you learn everything at the Sydney Institute.
Yeah.
Want to find out about your family history? Speak at the Sydney Institute. That's the way to handle it. We don't want to get too confused.
Did you mean the brass plaque?
Yeah.
No, that's not part of this. I did actually see a picture, thank goodness. I did actually see a picture in this sequence where they're outside the building that I know was their hostel in Winchester, because it was the old city mill, it's still there. And that picture's not here, but it's in the same sequence.
Okay, Stuart.
Okay, Hitler comes to power in January the 30th, 1933. Now, you said your grandfather's father had been a Social Democratic Party official.
Trade union leader.
And your grandfather had been a Social Democratic Party bodyguard, at their rallies. Weimar Republic, the Social Democrats were the main opponents to the Nazis.
Yeah.
Now, your grandfather's father is murdered by the Nazis post the 30th of January 1933.
Yeah.
And so your grandfather then, how hard did he find it to get out of Nazi Germany then? Is it easy to get out? Was it easy to get out?
I don't think so. From what I understand, and this is all... I mean, he never spoke about any of this, so I had to find out what I could from other sources. I have been told by a family source that he had a contact on the other side. So he had a sort of an insider who helped him to escape. And it was escaping. From what I understand, he would have been shot on sight had they found him. It's my understanding, I can't prove it, that Heinz, my grandfather, was importing weapons for a sort of for a violent opposition. This, to some extent, was visited upon the trade union leaders, one of whom was his father. And that episode where they occupied the trade union offices was part of a national movement against the left on that day. It happened pretty much everywhere.
There's a question there.
Just as a matter of interest,
speak up a fraction. Yeah.
I understand that the trade union secretaries of the time in the 30s were mainly Jewish, and that the Nazis were against them for that reason, also because they didn't want them organising labour. But that, if that is the case, how do you know that your grandfather and your great-grandfather weren't Jewish?
Well, you're not the first person to ask me that. I suppose I don't know, but I've just had no inklings of it from anything that I've found. I don't know if there's a way I can ever know. But as far as I know, as far as he said, he wasn't. And I think that my grandmother would have said something in this kind of unburdening that came after he died, if she had known. So as far as I know, no, but who knows?
So for those who missed the question was, how do you know your grandfather isn't Jewish? And the answer is, you don't really know, but you're pretty sure he wasn't. Yeah.
But he might have used the Jewish network to get himself out of Germany.
He might use a Jewish network to get him out of Germany.
That's not my understanding. He lived very close to the border. So it may have not been as necessary, you know, as somebody who lived in Berlin. That's not my understanding of how it happened.
It's a question then, yeah.
How long did it take to write?
I think I would say about 4 years with the research. There was a bit more with the edits at the end, but that period when I was working on it a lot of the time was about 4 years. It was longer to start off with. I scaled it back a bit, and the research period was about 6 months.
Did the family, your cousins in Germany, you can tell us a bit about how that eventuated, how did they react to all these secrets?
Okay, well, the whole of my family now, that is alive now, is just fascinated by this stuff. It was very helpful to have German cousins because my German is... I mean, I had some at school, but there's not much of it left, really. And so I have two cousins that grew up in Germany that have helped with translating things. My uncle spent quite a lot of time in Germany as an academic, his children were born there. But in general, the interest in the family, and the interesting thing is that my father and my uncle were very interested in it once I started writing it, but hadn't asked these questions themselves, because I think there's a fairly sort of familiar pattern of people not asking their parents things, and then the grandchildren are nosier and less afflicted by the relationship and just kind of delve in.
Yes.
You used the word horror, it seems to imply to me whether the theme of the book is very similar to the Diary of Anne Frank, that is, to illustrate the stupidity of Aryan supremacy of Hitler, and to warn the people that to be vigilant against it in the future. Is that what compelled you to write your book, warning people about this atrocity that you've been mentioning, the horrors?
I think it wasn't quite that, actually. And that feeling that I had of this horror, talking about this vent that led into the cellar where my great-grandfather was murdered, Actually, I think the book is much more about the relationships between these people and what those meant to them. And what I'm interested in, I suppose, is restoring these individual stories of love and loss to people and to our family, and getting away from that large-scale horror. I mean, to be honest, our family, you know, as far as I know, my grandfather's family was not Jewish. There isn't a story here of what we usually think of as survival in this context. What I was interested in, really at a very fundamental level, was what would it have felt like to have lived through all these things and to just give those stories their due. That was really what I was interested in.
Right, so we're going down the back. Yep, that's right, yeah. Just speak up a bit.
Why do you think your grandmother hid the fact that she was Jewish from her son?
Why did your grandmother hide the fact she was Jewish from her son?
Well, sure. I've talked to my dad about this. I mean, I think actually that Heinz hid the fact that she was Jewish, because as soon as he died, she told them. I think you know, this is the best I've got out of my father, and I can kind of see this. That he was an extremely private person, who I'm talking about publicly now, who didn't want people to assume that they knew what his story was. That he didn't want people saying, you know, that's why you had to leave, etc. Because it's slightly complex in that Faye was Jewish, but she didn't live in Germany. She wasn't in danger. It was Heinz that was in danger for other reasons. So the best that I could come up with was that he was just incredibly private and didn't want people to assume that they knew what this story was, what kind of story it was. But I don't know.
We get right down the back here.
Hi.
One of the relationships that's really interesting between Heinz and his father, who, am I right, was killed by the Nazis, in part for the work he was doing in the resistance.
That Heinz was doing?
Yes.
Yes.
And my question is two parts. Firstly, did Heinz carry much guilt for the rest of his life that maybe his actions led to that? And from your research, do you feel that his resistance to the Nazis was inspired by his father, and that his father was a resistor as well?
Okay, I don't know how Heinz felt about anything. I've had to put the pieces together. I can't imagine that all of these things could happen in one person's life and that you could not feel responsible in some way. But I may have misread the connection. I think my feeling and what I've done in the novel about his father's influence on him is that he was an old-fashioned social democrat. He wasn't a communist. He didn't believe in violent revolution. This is my great-grandfather. I think that because, in part, Heinz had been to war, he was a veteran, he was an officer, a non-commissioned officer, that he had skills and a kind of toughness that led him to go further than his father would ever have done. That's what I believe. As to guilt, I don't know. I imagine I would have thought so.
And did he continue any of his resistance work when he got to England? Or did he just get to England and say, I'm out now,
move on in life? I think that was him out, yes. I mean, I don't know that he could have contacted anybody, and I suspect that most of the people that he had been in contact with had either gone over to the Nazis by then or had been punished or put in camps or whatever.
Okay, just hang on a second. So have I missed anyone? Ellen, you want to have another go?
Yes, please.
I have helped people to record their experiences of the Holocaust and in the period after the Holocaust. I tend to find that old people get annoyed because of their grandchildren, their children and their grandchildren aren't really interested.
Okay.
And on the other hand, the young people are annoyed because the old people no longer wish to talk about it.
Okay, so do you want to comment on that?
Yeah.
Well, I was freed by them being dead, really. I didn't ask my grandmother while she was still alive. I was too young to be properly interested. And by the time I was a teenager, she was really descending into dementia. And so what I remember of her being lucid, I was quite a young child. But I think it is difficult. It doesn't always happen that the ages work together. It doesn't always work that your grandchild is old enough to be interested. I mean, these things often come when you have children yourself, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and by that stage, you don't always have your grandparents anymore. And I never had my grandfather. He died before I was born.
Yeah, we're getting near the end. Have I missed anyone? Very briefly, Hilary.
Yes.
Yeah.
The Germans were not interned in the same camp or same place as the Jews. The Jewish internment from my husband was a very creative, educational experience for him. But was he, Heinz, interned in with the Germans? What sort of internment was that? Or was he interned with the Jews where he would have been, studying and learning?
In Australia?
In Australia, yeah.
Yeah. No, he was with, I mean, my understanding is that most of them were Jews, and I believe that he was with them. But I don't know anything about friendships or associations.
I thought they were separated.
I don't think so. I think no, they weren't. They're all in together.
I think there were Nazis at Tatura. But I don't think they separated them, and that was a source of quite a lot of stress.
I think they didn't separate the Jews and the non-Jews. The Germans are all in together, whether they were Jews or non-Jews. Yeah, they're all in together. So, Tom, final question.
How did the family deal with the fact that the young blonde lad went into the youth army, which was contrary to probably
Yes, well, there's a...
No, I think you should give him an answer.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I think it was a total secret that he had ever existed for many years, actually. I think that was how the family dealt with it. And it's fascinating to us. And also, I mean, the other thing about, as you said, Jared, fighting for... the Hitler Youth Army, it's not like you had a choice. So it's not like saying my uncle was in the SS, etc. This was a boy who would have been 17. It was just never spoken about.
So finally, how committed are you to your life as a novelist? I mean, have you thought about biography? Have you thought about history? And what after this? What's next?
I am a novelist. I found the scope of this so fascinating. I would probably work with history again, but I'm not a historian. I love reading history, but that's just not what comes out when I sit down.
What's next?
I think it's too new and raw to speak about in public. Another novel.
You sound like your grandfather. I want to talk about it in public. Anyway, Belinda Castles, many thanks for a fine presentation this evening. As I said, Janet Grundy's got copies of Hannah and Emil outside, and there will be a new novel about a topic that no one's to know about. But sometime in the future, we'll have you back here to talk about it. But for tonight, many thanks for a fine sort of run through the period and the relationship of Australia to these events in these traumatic and terrible events in Europe at the time. And also for talking about your your family, and we'll all go and read the book to find out what happened to the blonde kid. But maybe he got his hair dyed. I mean, who would know? So many thanks for tonight.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.